Hello. Welcome to the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 3rd, 2025. This is hour two of our reading. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. And we begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Theodora Rose Bowman, Michael Cafaro, Judith Carol Charlton, Sherry Brooks Compton, Glenn William Davis, Max E. Dilgard, Janet Dunapace, Thomas Arment Highfield, Richard Ernest Hollenbeck, known as R.D., Cleta Grace McCormick, Leonard Edward Milowski, Jr., Arnold J. Nicola, known as Nick, Robert Lee Reed, Mary Lynn Hartman Schuttenberg, and Terrence Patrick Woods. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends his condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. Looks like we have two articles here. The first one is written by Russ Wiles for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, AZ Income Gains Rank High, But Growth Slows. Arizona generated the third highest amount of cumulative personal income gains of any state over a recent 10-year period, while placing fourth in migration, according to a new mapping service unveiled by a former Trump economic advisor. But the report does not reflect recent slowdowns for Arizonans in both measures. Former Trump senior economic advisor Steve Moore unveiled the new interactive website that allows users to evaluate statewide changes in personal income, migration, and political affiliation over different years between 2012 and 2022. It relies on Internal Revenue Service data and U.S. Census Bureau data. Now, the IRS waits 3 years before releasing personal income and other tax information for residents in specific states, which makes the data from 2022 the most recent. These trends can be seen at the VoteWithYourFeet.net website, which also allows tracking between individual states. The website is a project of Moore's Unleash Prosperity organization. From 2012 to 2022, cumulative personal incomes reported by Arizona residents increased by $29.8 billion, trailing only a $195.6 billion surge in Florida and a $54.5 billion in Texas, and they ranked just ahead of the $28.3 billion in North Carolina. Now, personal income is measured by net adjusted gross income for residents of each state, as reported to the IRS on tax returns. New York suffered the biggest outflow of cumulative personal income at $111.1 billion, followed by California at $102.4 billion, and Illinois at $63.5 billion. But over the same period, Arizona attracted a net 483,000 new residents coming from other states, ranking just fourth behind Florida, Texas, and North Carolina. And New York lost 1.76 million residents, California lost 1.63 million, and Illinois lost 881,000. In the process, Arizona has largely retained a red state slant in terms of the governor's office and the two branches of the legislature through 2022. However, Arizona became more purple with Democrat Katie Hobbs elected governor in 2022 and with two Democratic U.S. senators in Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego. Now, the website does not track the political affiliation of U.S. senators or representatives. Moore, who is an economic conservative, sees these and other results as signs that Americans have been moving to more low-tax, pro-growth states, including Arizona, in search of affordability and economic freedom, Many Sun Belt states have benefited from Americans' preference for warmer climates, he noted, but tax and other policies also matter. He cited California, with some of the nation's highest personal income tax rates, as a prime example of economic policies that can go wrong. He said, quote, "This is the first time that California is losing population despite its exceptional weather. How do you screw up California?" Unquote. Beneficiaries have included states like Arizona, with a low 2.5% flat tax. However, Arizona's job growth has slowed, and the state now ranks near the bottom so far in 2025, suggesting that other factors also are at play. Similarly, Arizona lately has attracted fewer newcomers from other states. And that was Russ Wiles' article, "Arizona Income Gains Rank High, But Growth Slows." And our second article from the economy section of the paper is entitled "BBB Warning of New Passport Renewal Scams." This was written by Tamia Fowlikas from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel out of Milwaukee. A new scam targeting international travelers is encouraging Americans to complete their passport and visa applications through a fraudulent site. Wisconsin resident Anthony Braun was preparing to go on vacation with his wife when he realized that his passport's expiration date was just 6 months away. Braun decided to do a quick Google search for passport renewal, and the top option was uspassportandvisa.org. This fraudulent website falsely claims to assist users in their international travel process, including passport and visa renewal. Braun was charged $66, but no passport renewal ever came. Instead, a pop-up message from the website instructed him to download the free passport renewal form from the U.S. Department of State website and take it to a U.S. Postal Service office to submit and pay. Well, that scam website, which was launched last January, has successfully collected thousands of dollars from unwitting customers, according to the Better Business Bureau. The BBB scam tracker has recorded more than 80 reports of fraudulent activity on the website, including the collection of Social Security numbers, bank information, and passport numbers. When Braun contacted the company, a spokesperson said the organization never claimed to partake in the passport or visa renewal process, but did offer resources to help consumers complete the applications. Braun said, quote, "I should have checked that first, and I didn't, because the website looked so good," unquote. The BBB said that it frequently hears from consumers who click on one of the first websites to pop up after a search, and they get fooled. Lisa Schiller, a senior director of investigations and media relations at BBB Wisconsin, Lisa said, quote, "Scammers can pay to have their fake websites appear as sponsored ads at the top of search engine results, mimicking the look and feel of legitimate businesses," unquote. Now, you can apply for a passport through the U.S. State Department website or by mail. Passport applications can also be completed at U.S. Postal Service offices. There are no businesses that can offer expedited passport delivery. The websites that appear on Google are not always safe to use. To renew a passport, all applications and information can be found at travel.state.gov. Before entering your personal information, search the website or business on BBB Scam Tracker. If you identify a scam, report it promptly to your bank, credit card company, local and federal government agencies, and the BBB. And that was the article that was entitled "BBB Warning of New Passport Renewal Scams." Well, we're coming up on 10 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over from the economy section to the sports section. What's on the front page of the sports section? Okay, so the cover story from the sports section is all about the Arizona Cardinals. And at the top of the page, there's a picture of four Cardinals fans at the front row leaning over the edge of the banister. And they've got their Cardinals jerseys on, and they've got their face painted, and they're cheering. But they were cheering during training camp on July 27th in Glendale. The title of the article underneath that picture is Cardinals Will Be Much Better Than Last Season. And this is an article written by Greg Moore for the Arizona Republic. The fans who came out to watch training camp at State Farm Stadium have no doubt the Arizona Cardinals are going to be good this season. Well, how good? That depends on who you ask. Santiago Valadez said, the best in the league. They're winning the Super Bowl this year. Well, Santé is 11. And he spoke for himself, plus his buddies, Emilio Dominguez, who is 12, and Mario Tovar Jr., who's 11. Now, Mario Tovar Sr., he's a little more measured. He's 32, and he's been watching the Cardinals since he was a kid. He said, quote, I feel like we're headed in the right direction. For the most part, they will be good. I'm just looking forward to seeing what happens this season, unquote. Well, Mario Tovar put it perfectly, because we are all looking forward to seeing what happens this season. Arizona fans have been burned by expectations. A couple of Vegas odds makers, they're predicting that the Cardinals will be about the same as last year, when they won 8 games. One sportsbook called DraftKings has Arizona starting off at 5-1, but going just 2-9 down the stretch. That's 7-10 overall if you need help counting. I think they'll be better than that, but I'm wrestling with my preseason prediction for a lot of reasons. First off, I hate preseason predictions, especially at football. There are too many variables to expect much accuracy. Aside from that, I've been burned recently by the Suns and the Diamondbacks. I thought both teams would be pretty good. The Suns turned in their most disappointing season in franchise history. The Diamondbacks are about 3/4 of the way through a similar mess. You know, pretty good is a galactic understatement. I thought the Suns could win a title with Devin Booker and Kevin Durant. And I thought Corbin Burns would give the D-backs enough of an edge with his cutter to challenge the Dodgers for the NL West crown. Well, it goes both ways. Famously, Arizona State football was predicted to finish last in the Big 12 last year. The Sun Devils heard that, and then they went to the college football playoff. I even had to write an apology song. Now, none of that has anything to do with the Cardinals and what they will or won't do this year. But all of it is on my mind as I try to sort whether I think Arizona can win the NFC West or make a deep playoff push. I went live on 12 News, the NBC affiliate, with Cameron Cox moments before the Cardinals drafted Walter Nolan back in April. I said then that if Monty Ossenfort got the pick right, Arizona would return to the playoffs. Now, yeah, I am aware that it would only be the second time in the last decade that this happened. But Cam is a walking pep rally. You stand next to him long enough, and you'd have picked the prisoners without Adam Sandler to beat the guards in the longest yard. You know, I'm joking. Cam does know his stuff. If he says a team will be good, you can be certain there's good reason for it. Anyway, this proves why this exercise is so difficult. Walter Nolan hasn't played a snap this preseason. Nolan is dealing with an injury. We have no idea how bad it is. Last season, it was Darius Robinson. And the year before that, Isaiah Simmons went from starter to cut from the team after the first preseason game. We just don't know. And if we assume that everything breaks right for the Cardinals, well, then logically we have to assume that everything breaks right for everybody else as well. So now, my mental health is at risk. Okay, to bring this all the way down, this is my 9th season covering this franchise. I remember when new Cardinals radio analyst A.Q. Shipley was a player in the locker room. And it's my job, dear reader, whether I think this team will be any good. Yes. Barring injury, the defense will be a problem for any opponent. I'm looking for a consistent pass rush and more takeaways than last season. Budda Baker will remain the closest thing the NFL has to Troy Polamalu or a healthy Bob Sanders. I'm looking for Kyler Murray to play like a top five guy every single game for a full season. If he does, this is his franchise for the foreseeable future. If he gets derailed by injury or poor play again, Monty Austinfort will need to find his replacement. Now, Jonathan Gannon has proved to be an outstanding leader and motivator. Now I'm looking for him to make a call or two that saves a game, which could be the difference between making the playoffs and staying home. I'm looking for Paris Johnson Jr. to become a wall protecting Kyler's blindside and paving a road for James Conner to truck defenders on. I'm looking for Marvin Harrison Jr. to top 1,000 yards receiving and stop bulking before people start comparing him to another promising Ohio State guy that we had out there, David Boston. Yeah, for now, Harrison does look like he's incredible in camp. So I'm also looking forward to seeing fans wearing his number 18 jersey now that it is available from the team shop. I'm looking for Trey McBride to take over the number one spot as the best tight end in the NFL. And I'm looking for offensive coordinator Drew Petzing to call McBride's number a bit more inside the 20-yard line. Bottom line, there are a lot of ifs, but I'm calling for the Cardinals to win 11 games, make the playoffs, and beat the Seahawks for the first time since Calais Campbell was in diapers. Then again, I was hanging around some fans who were so enthusiastic, they make my guy Cam sound like an undertaker. 27-year-old Kaylee Reed said, quote, "All we've done is shore up our weak points." Kaylee was sitting in the front row to watch Arizona's first day of practice with pads. And Reed then broke down in microscopic detail how the defense has been improved through the draft and free agency, and how the offense will benefit from continuity. Reed said, quote, "We're going to be a really good team this year," unquote. And that was Greg Moore's cover article, "Cardinals Will Be Much Better Than Last Season." Okay, here's an article about the D-backs. It's entitled, "Six-Game Homestand Versus West Padres and Rockies," written by Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. With the MLB trade deadline in the rearview mirror, the Diamondbacks wrap up a 3-game series in Sacramento against the Athletics on Sunday, August 3rd. Left-hander Eduardo Rodriguez is scheduled to start for Arizona at Sutter Health Park. Now, this game concludes a 9-game road trip. When the Diamondbacks return to Phoenix, they will be at Chase Field for 3 games against the San Diego Padres, August 4th, 5th, and 6th, and then the Colorado Rockies, August 8th, 9th, and 10th. Facing a division rival that is contending for a National League wildcard spot, the Diamondbacks could certainly enjoy using a sweep of the Padres to help keep alive their own fading postseason hopes. The Diamondbacks took 2 of 3 from the Padres at home in June, and they split a 4-game series in San Diego between July 7th and 10th. They will face the Padres to end the regular season in September. The Padres have taken control of second place in the NL West behind the Dodgers, with the Giants having fallen to a clear third place. All-star third baseman Manny Machado paces the offense, but the Padres have solid hitters in Fernando Tatis Jr., Luis Arraez, and Jackson Merrill. The bullpen is one of the best in the majors, And on June 29th, they led the MLB in saves with 36. Robert Suarez has most of those. The Rockies have by far the most losses and the fewest wins among the MLB teams, and that will be the case when their series with the Diamondbacks starts. Arizona has taken 4 of 6 meetings this season, with 7 games left between the two teams. August 9th is Corbin Carroll Star Wars-themed bobblehead night at Chase Field for the first 20,000 fans to arrive. And that's the article 6-game homestand versus West's Padres and Rockies. Our next article, home games include Fever, maybe Clark. This is all about the WNBA, written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Mercury finished their longest road trip of the season in Chicago against the Sky on Sunday, August 3rd. And a few days later, the Mercury return home for a 4-game homestand, the longest of the season. Against the Sky, the Mercury have a chance to take the season series after going 2-0 in the last 2 meetings. The teams have not met since the Mercury hit 17 three-pointers in that 107-86 blowout back on June 21st in Chicago. The Sky remain one of the teams vying for a lottery picket, but forward Angel Reese has been enjoying a big season with 16 double-doubles in 22 games. The current WNBA single-season record for double-doubles is held by Alyssa Thomas. She recorded 28 in 2023. The Mercury will host the Connecticut Sun on Tuesday, August 5th at PHX Arena at 7 p.m. The two teams last met in Connecticut on June 18th, where the Mercury won 83-75. The homestand will continue on Thursday, August 7th, with the Indiana Fever and the possible return of Caitlin Clark. The meeting also marks the return of former Mercury guard Sophie Cunningham after she was traded in the offseason. Cunningham spent her first 6 seasons with the Mercury and gained attention during the 2021 WNBA Finals run with 21 points in the first-round knockout game against the New York Liberty. So with the Fever, Cunningham has averaged 7.5 points and 1.5 three-pointers off the bench. Now, all of the WNBA games will be shown locally on Arizona's Family 3 TV and Arizona's Family Sports. And that was Jenna Ortiz's article, Home Games Include Fever, Maybe Clark. And our final article in the sports section today is Who is Set for Playoff Return? Written by Michael Middlehurst Schwartz for the USA Today. At the beginning of each NFL season, it can be difficult to imagine widespread challenges to the incumbent contending class. But when it comes to the postseason field, change is a given. Now, last season might have been more static than previous campaigns were, with only 4 playoff newcomers, 2 in each conference, shaking things up. But that number has been the minimum number of fresh entrants for every season since 1990, with as much as many as 8 swaps in 2022, for example. So, will 2025 produce another relatively muted shift in the postseason landscape? Or are things ripe for a shakeup? So now, with training camps open, here is our look at last year's playoff teams, ranked from most likely to return to least likely to return to the playoffs. Number 1, most likely, the Buffalo Bills. With the core returning for a team that yet again saw its Super Bowl shot slip through its hands, Buffalo belongs near the top of any preseason power rankings. In claiming the AFC East for the 5th consecutive season in 2024, Josh Allen and company managed to become the first team since the 2009 Indianapolis Colts to seal a division crown with at least 5 weeks remaining. With the gap between them and a trio of also-rans as wide as ever, The bills have a sizable margin for error in the event of any slippage. Number two, the Philadelphia Eagles. In the last 10 years, only two teams, the 2016 Denver Broncos and the 2022 Los Angeles Rams, failed to reach the postseason the year after winning the Super Bowl. The Eagles do not appear particularly liable to join them. Of course, there are no guarantees about Jalen Hurts' health, as quarterback entropy drove both of the other teams' rapid downfalls. But with an offensive front that remains the league's standard bearer, and an overall level of depth seldom seen elsewhere in the league, Philadelphia has become the embodiment of stability. Number three, the Baltimore Ravens. Since Lamar Jackson was drafted in 2018, the lone season in which Baltimore failed to make the playoffs came in 2021, when a calamitous spate of personnel losses, 25 players landed on injured reserve at some point, and there was a brutal run of close losses in the final weeks. That's what did the team in. Maybe there's cause for concern there for a group that benefited from uncommon injury luck last season, with the Ravens easily having the fewest adjusted games lost in the metric that was developed by FTN Fantasy's Aaron Schatz. But even a regression to the mean might not be enough to stop a group that returns nearly every starter from last year's 13-win crew. Number four on our list is the Kansas City Chiefs. After the two-time defending champions ran their win streak in one-score games to 17, boosted by a 12-0 mark last season, including the playoffs, before the surprising Super Bowl smackdown, many delighted in what they saw as comeuppance for an imperfect squad. But despite the inherent luck involved, Kansas City's unparalleled aptitude in tight contest might be indicative of this group's ability to find the narrowest of edges, even when dealt with other setbacks. Regardless, the Eagles' triumph very well could prove no more indicative of a downfall than the Buccaneers' Super Bowl 55 rout over Patrick Mahomes and company. The 9-time defending AFC West champions could face some actual heat in the division, but barring catastrophic injury, those odds seem remote. Number five, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Perhaps their contending credentials aren't quite as strong as the NFC's other returning playoff entrants, but the four-time defending NFC South champions don't have as treacherous of a path to the postseason as their competition. While Liam Cohen's departure might still sting, there is a foundation in place for new coordinator Josh Grizzard to maintain the pace for an offense that ranked fifth in expected points added per play. All-pro left tackle Tristan Wirfs' early season absence due to an off-season knee injury, however, does loom as something that could trip up the team out of the gates. Number six would be the Detroit Lions. On one hand, Detroit is due a hefty dose of respect after leading the NFL in point differential, despite an almost historic level of bad injury luck on defense. But on the other hand, it will be exceedingly difficult for the Lions to reprise their 6-0 finish within a division that has only gotten even more cutthroat, with the loss of coordinators Ben Johnson and Aaron Glenn threatening to drain the institutional advantage that had allowed the organization to push past so many hits elsewhere. Dan Campbell should be able to retain some semblance of stability on both sides of the ball, given the familiarity of John Martin and Kevin Shepard that have with his operation, so don't count on a collapse. Number seven would be the Los Angeles Rams. Not only were the Rams the only team to claim a division via tiebreaker, they also were the lone playoff team to post a negative point differential, minus 19. But with Devontae Adams touting his rejuvenation upon his arrival to Los Angeles and a promising defense continuing to coalesce, this is a team that is clearly on the upswing Now, there are no guarantees in the NFC West, which is one of the few divisions with four teams legitimately capable of finishing first in 2025. But a team that doesn't look outmatched by the Eagles in the divisional round remains the class of the group for now, and the Rams should be a leading contender for a wild card spot, even if they're knocked from their perch. Number 8 would be the Denver Broncos. Seeing Peyton's crew last season beat out even the most optimistic timelines for a turnaround, ending what had been the NFL's second longest active playoff drought, despite carrying a record $89 million in dead cap charges. But Denver's 1-6 record in one-score games highlighted a clear avenue for growth. Threatening defenses downfield more often will be a vital step in the Broncos establishing that they can compete with the AFC's best, given that just two of their 2024 victories came against a team that finished with a winning record. One was against the Kansas City team that resting its starters in Week 18. Bo Nix should have much more help thanks to J.K. Dobbins, and rookie R.J. Harvey invigorating their inefficient rushing attack. And number 9, the Green Bay Packers. When Jordan Love and the Packers' passing attack saw an upward trajectory inverted in a trying end to the 2024 season, consternation followed. And while Green Bay did not break its 23-year first-round receiver drought merely for the amusement of fans at year's draft, maybe the offense's ills have been somewhat overstated. If the Packers can open things back up and shake the drops that plagued the receiving corps throughout the season, returning to the playoffs for the 6th time in 7 years under Matt LaFleur, it shouldn't be much of a problem. And finally, number 10, the Minnesota Vikings. After remaking its fronts with these three new starters on the interior offensive line and two more on the defensive front, Minnesota boasts what is one of the league's most well-rounded rosters. Why, then, would a group that won 14 games last season and nearly claimed the NFC's top seed be placed below so many other teams on this list? Well, for as much as it's clear about an otherwise proven collection of talent in Minnesota, the installation of J.J. McCarthy as the starting quarterback still leaves this team as somewhat of a mystery. Now, to be fair, General Manager Kwesi Adolfo-Mensah has done an outstanding job of setting up a support system for the 2024 first-round pick to thrive in this transition. And that's the article, Who is Set for Playoff Return? Well, we're coming up on 33 minutes past the hour. I guess we better go find some opinion pieces. Our first opinion piece was written by Elvia Diaz, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, What I Learned from Quieter Chats with an Arizona Legend. Here's what she wrote. Alfredo Gutierrez wasn't just a force in Arizona politics. He was the force. He was the architect of countless fights for justice, the moral voice behind civil rights and immigrant protest, and the stubborn soul who believed, literally to his last breath, that it was his duty to keep fighting. Gutierrez died on July 29th at age 79. But the fire that I witnessed over the last two decades of knowing him, the fire that inspired movements, won't go away. To say that Alfredo shaped generations is not an exaggeration. He lit generations. What Arizonans are saying about him and how he touched their lives is a testament to that. Community activist Karina Guyen, wrote on Facebook, remembering his protest against Proposition 300 that denied in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants. She said, quote, his presence gave me courage. His arrest reminded us of the cost of speaking truth to power, unquote. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays wrote on X, quote, Alfredo was a towering figure in Arizona history, an unapologetic fighter for justice, equality, and the civil rights of all Arizonans. His legacy will live on in generations that he empowered, unquote. When I think of Alfredo, I think of a thoughtful leader who moved in business and Republican circles, with the same ease as the rabble-rouser who is willing to leap from a crowd at an anti-Trump rally, snatching a Trump flag from a supporter's hands. That's a rarity. And vintage Gutierrez, brazen, righteous, unflinching in those moments, which were countless over the decades when he put everything on the line, including his freedom. He reminded me as a journalist and later as a columnist that silence is never an option in the face of injustice. People like him inspired me to speak up without fear, but with clear eyes about the consequences. And yet, it was the quieter chats that will remain etched in my mind, just as his political fights at the Arizona State Capitol will remain his most consequential gift to Arizonans. When I asked him recently to point to a proud moment, he mentioned his role in creating Access, one of the few remember to or knew that he played. Alfredo, who spent 14 years at the state legislature, was key in the creation of the state's Medicaid program, known as the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, AHCCCS. More than 2 million people are enrolled in the program now. Born in Miami, Arizona, Alfredo was destined to a life as a guest of county facilities, is what he often joked. That's when he landed, in his early days, when he landed in court. But thankfully, a judge offered him a choice to either go to juvenile detention or join the military. So he went to the Army and served in Vietnam. When he returned, he enrolled at Arizona State University to study history and philosophy. But it did not take long before activism overtook academics. Instead of reading books and doing homework, he helped co-found the Mexican-American Student Organization at ASU. He worked with the legendary farm worker leader, Cesar Chavez, and he co-founded Chicanos por la Casa, which is now one of the nation's largest nonprofit organizations. A common theme of his life is his deep belief in the power of organized people, not just protest, but actual, tangible, and lasting progress. At the age of 27, he was elected to the state legislature, where it only took him 2 years to become the leader of the Democratic Majority Caucus. He took his fight to the halls of power for the same people he once marched with in the streets, and he never played it safe. The Arizona Republic deemed him early on as a radical. Presumably, that was meant to be disparaging, but he viewed it as a badge of honor throughout his career. He left the legislature in 1987 to form a crisis consultancy firm, where he did well financially. But even there, he ruffled feathers, with some accusing him of selling out because he took clients that his younger activist self might have scorned. But Alfredo never apologized for evolving because he understood power, and he knew how to wield it at every turn. Alfredo returned to the front lines to fight Arizona's notorious anti-immigrant law, known as Senate Bill 1070. He led protest and hosted a Spanish-language radio show where he informed and inspired listeners. He wrote for us, the Arizona Republic, and La Voz whenever I asked him to do so. He was everywhere, and few could articulate the momentous fight to local and national media in both English and Spanish. In 2013, he published, quote, To Sin Against Hope, unquote. It's a memoir that minces no words. It lashed out at Democrats and Republicans, even fellow activists. I loved that about Alfredo. He wasn't here to be liked. He was here to push us, to provoke us into action. That same drive was evident when he joined the Maricopa County Community College Board in 2014. He served as president before leaving in 2018. Alfredo never stopped. Not when he was expelled from ASU for leading student protest in the late 1960s, only to return decades later to finish that college degree. Not when he lost the Democratic nomination for governor against Janet Napolitano in 2002. Not when critics tried to write him off. Not even when cancer came for him. Alfredo is survived by his wife, Sharon Zapata, and his sons, Sam, Ben, and Luis. But he's also survived by every student who ever believed that college was possible because he told them so. He is survived by every worker who marched for a contract, by every immigrant who crossed the border hoping for a better life and found an advocate in him. Alfredo Gutierrez was a man of steel, but he was also a man of soul. He shaped lives, opened minds, lit fires of justice that will never go out. We won't forget. We can't forget. And that was Elvia Diaz's column, What I Learned from Quieter Chats with an Arizona Legend. Our next opinion piece is written by Joanna Allhands, who has a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, Another Game Changer in Arizona City's Quest for More Water. Metro Phoenix needs more water. Using less of what we have is critical, but conservation alone will not be enough to sustain the Valley of the Sun for the long haul. We need additional supplies, and we need them in a hurry. And that's why tapping the Harquahala groundwater basin west of Phoenix is such a big deal. Though state law has enabled groundwater transfers from a handful of basins since the 1990s, this is the first such deal to earn the state water department's approval. A collection of Harquahala Valley landowners wants to sell about 8 million acre feet over the next 100 years to water providers within central Arizona, using a novel approach to, quote, master plan, unquote, the withdrawals, much like a developer would plan a giant housing development over time. Queen Creek and Buckeye were the first to sign up and have each gotten state approval to transport roughly 5,000 acre feet of this groundwater annually, which collectively amounts to 1 million acre feet over the next century. That means more than 85% of the Harquahala Project's water remains available for additional purchases, and plenty of water providers besides Queen Creek are expected to vie for it, especially when the water starts flowing. Now, it could still be a few years before that happens. Pipelines must be constructed to move the water to a central water treatment site, which also must be constructed, and then funneled into the Central Arizona Project Canal for transport. This treated groundwater must meet certain quality standards before it can be mixed with Colorado River water already flowing through the canal. Proving as much will entail a formal federal environmental assessment, plus agreements to transport the water using the canal. It is a lot of water, a lot of work, but tapping the Harquahala could be a game changer, particularly for cities like Queen Creek and Buckeye that rely heavily on groundwater. Queen Creek, for example, plans to use this first allotment to offset its pumping for current customers, significantly reducing the area's long-term unmet demand for groundwater. The town also plans to acquire a future allotment to serve any homes that get built under the state's new Ag-to-Urban program, taking pressure off the already strained Central Arizona Groundwater Replenishment District to replenish what those future homes would pump. So combined, those two allotments are expected to replace as much as half of the water that Queen Creek would otherwise be removing from its aquifer. But wait, you might say. The water from the Harquahala Valley is still groundwater. It is not being replenished. Even if experts say the basin has enough water for Queen Creek, Buckeye, and others to rely on for the next 100 years, why would we support customers with a finite source that will eventually run out? Because this is not the end-all, be-all. It is meant to be a transition supply, one that can help bridge the gap between now and other long-term renewable water projects that are still taking shape. Plus, the amount of water that would be transferred to cities over time is slightly less than what Harquahala farmers have historically been using. Arguably, this saves groundwater overall, because cities like Buckeye and Queen Creek are using Harquahala water, which would have been used anyway if these lands had continued farming, instead of pumping what's under their feet. Now I get that this still makes some folks nervous. Nearly 30,000 acres, a swath of farmland larger than the city of Tempe, will never again grow crops like alfalfa, forever changing the look and feel of the far west Maricopa County. There is fear that the Harquahala project will put market pressure on other rural basins, even those that aren't transportation basins, to stop farming and send their water to central Arizona. Critics also argue that we should not allow growth on groundwater, period, even if there is enough to supply new users for 100 years. It's a brave new world we're entering, with deep cuts to Colorado River supplies on the immediate horizon, and a lot of folks scrambling to figure out how they'll make up the difference when that water goes away. Transporting water, groundwater, is not a perfect solution, but no water deal is going to be. On the whole, it does more good than harm, offering cities a much-needed opportunity to shore up what they have got. And that's Joanna Allhand's opinion piece, another game-changer in Arizona City's quest for more water. Well, we've passed 46 minutes past the hour, so we need to move on over to the entertainment section, and so we can begin with today's horoscopes. And we will begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you taking the road less traveled? An out-of-character move is prompted. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, birth dates. Are you searching for the true story? Avoid reading into subtext that is not there. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st. Are relationship matters making you anxious? Overreacting will exacerbate a conflict, so play it cool. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. Are you getting in your own way? Life is almost too easy, so let it be. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd. Are you ready for a little fun? Well, then play, but be mindful of mood swings. For you fellow Virgos out there with birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, you need space to think, but everyone is meddling in your business. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, keep the conversation going. Follow your curiosity without getting attached to specifics. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, if only you had X, you would feel more secure, right? Well, your instincts could be off base. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, you know your next move, or do you? The moon throws a wrench in the works. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, a harsh reality disturbs your inner peace. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, the freedom you crave might not look how you expect it to while the moon moves through Sagittarius today. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Interruptions upset your professional game plan. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I recently reconnected with a woman that I dated briefly in the 1980s and haven't seen since. She's around my age. We both were married 1 year apart, had daughters 1 year apart, and got divorced after 20-year marriages. She spotted me on a social media site and suggested I call her to catch up on things, which I did. And this led to an invitation to meet for a bite to eat and more talk, which I gladly accepted. We live 2 hours apart, and I drove to her home to meet her. We had a great day and evening, and as I was leaving, I gave her a hug and a kiss on the cheek, whereupon she planted one on me. I wasn't expecting it, but it was awesome. I felt like a school kid with a crush. I had forgotten that feelings like this were even possible. We have spent every weekend together since that meeting last month. I have a special place in my heart for her, even from so long ago. My problem? I said the L word way too soon. I needed to rectify my misstep and explain that it was intended to represent caring and affection, as opposed to being romantically in love with her, which, for me, is an ongoing, more protracted process most of the time. I told her I have no expectation of her reciprocating. I just wanted her to know that I care for her and always have. I know some women, and maybe men, shudder to hear these words too soon in a relationship. She may be one of them. Anything else I can do to lessen her trepidation as we progress? Is there any recommended time frame for appropriately professing one's romantic love? Signed, Former Ex in Texas. And Abby responds, Dear Former Ex, I wish you had mentioned how this woman reacted when the word love escaped your lips. Did she smile, cringe, remain silent? There is no timetable for expressing love. The time to use the word is when one feels it. Sometimes the feeling lasts. Sometimes it doesn't. From now on, take your cues from her. If what you said made her uncomfortable, you would already know. Let your relationship progress at its own rate and resist the urge to force it. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I live with a man I admire very much. We bought our first home when we were 23. We had two children together and also raised my sister. We both work and want for nothing. The problem, he is an alcoholic. He never gets loud or mean. He just quietly goes to sleep. Now, from the outside, he looks like the greatest guy. But, Abby, I am so lonely that I cry sometimes. He is asleep by 2 or 3 p.m. on the weekends. We hardly ever go out. We are both 57. All the kids have moved out, and we should be having fun. I want to travel, dance, and hike, and he's happy getting drunk in the garage. Help. Signed, Lonesome Out West. Abby responds, Dear Lonesome, have you talked with him to see which issues have driven him to live this way? If your dream is to dance and hike, get out there and do it. Because Rip Van Winkle is passed out, it won't be like you're neglecting him, and he won't miss you. Because you want to travel, arrange to do it with friends. Consider attending Al-Anon meetings so you can find support and the strength to begin living your life the way you want, which is what he has been doing. And those were the letters of advice from Abigail Van Buren. Hey, we've got time for a couple of comics. And the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. In the first frame, Beetle and Sergeant Snorkel are standing up on a, looks like the top of a hill, maybe, it's the top of a hill, and Beetle says, and you can see out in the distance the sunset, and Beetle says, look at that view, did you ever see anything like it? And Sergeant Snorkel goes, nice. And the next frame, Beetle says, that's all you can say, nice? And Sergeant Snorkel says, very nice. In the next frame, Beetle's kind of getting upset, and he says, come on, it's spectacular, magnificent, gorgeous. And Sergeant Snorkel says, that's what I said, very nice. In the next frame, Beetle's jumping up and down. He says, you drive me crazy. You are so thick-headed. And then, in the next frame, part of the ground that he's been jumping up and down on starts to slip away. And Beetle goes, whoa. And in the last frame, turns out they've been standing on the edge of a cliff, and Beetle is now hanging on to a tree just below the edge of the cliff, and Sergeant Snorkel looks out the sunrise or sunset and says, ooh, I see what you mean now. It's really nice. And that was Beetle Bailey. And in the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, in the first frame, Dagwood's coming in the front door, and Daisy the dog is there, and she's wagging her tail, and he says, Daisy, shh, Daisy, no tail wagging. And the next frame, he's climbing the stairs. And the next frame, he's in the bedroom. Oh, Blondie's asleep, facing the other way on the bed, and he's got his pajamas out. The next frame, he's got his pajamas on, and he climbs into bed. The next frame, he's laying down in bed on his head on the pillow. And in the last frame, Blondie says, "Honey, do you remember to bring me any leftover pizza from the poker game?" Okay, so now we know. That was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first three frames, you just see the dad mowing the lawn with the rrrr written across the top of the frame. And he goes left and he goes right. And he's just mowing the lawn. And then in the third or fourth frame, all of a sudden his lawnmower starts making this weird sound, and he stops, and then in the last frame, he goes to his wife, and quietly says to her, "We need to have a private, closed caskets funeral for a certain Barbie." We all know how that goes, and that was Baby Blues. Before we go, we'd like to wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Today, the actor Martin Sheen is celebrating his 85th birthday, and entrepreneur Martha Stewart is celebrating her 83rd birthday. Director John Landis is celebrating his 75th. The singer James Hatfield with the group Metallica, he turned 62 today. And the singer and songwriter Ed Roland with the group Collective Soul, he turned 62 today. I'm Gene, volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the Reading of the Republic for Sunday, August 3rd, 2025. Have a great day.